This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. The former Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, says it'll be time to restart a measured discussion about an Australian Republic after Queen Elizabeth's funeral. In her first interview since the Queen's death, Ms. Gillard cautions the process won't be quick and thinks planning for a referendum will probably take several years. She sat down with reporter James Glenday in London to reflect on her memories of the late Queen.
I do have quite a few memories, actually. I welcomed the Queen to Australia when she came for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which we held in Perth. And, of course, she took that opportunity to travel extensively around the country. And what wasn't said at the time, but sort of everybody knew, was that it was going to be her last visit to Australia. And I do remember, in terms of her stoicism, we were there backstage at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting opening. And what was happening at the opening, towards the end of it, was that each leader of the 54 countries was going to come out on stage, be announced, be applauded. And then I would come out second last and she would come out last. So we're in this big queue waiting to go on stage, moving very slowly. So I said to her, can I get someone to get you a chair? And she was like, no, I'm fine to stand. And I'm like, that's really a pity, because if someone had got you a chair, then someone might have brought me a chair and I wouldn't have minded it. So, someone with a great dedication to duty.
You were born in Wales, so in the United Kingdom. What do you make of the outpouring of grief that we're seeing?
At the centre of this, of course, is just the human story of loss and grief. A family has lost a beloved member, and because the family is so on the public stage, we're sharing in that moment. She was this sort of continuity, you know, whatever else was happening, you would see images of the Queen, and I think for many there was kind of just a comfort in that. It was like there was this sort of quiet zone in this chaotic, fractured world, and I think the loss of that is also causing this wave of public emotion. What we've got to remember, of course, though, is everybody's different, everybody's experience is different. Where you stand in relation to the monarchy, the crown, the symbol of it, depends on personal life experience. So many around the world are seeing this quite differently.
And I wanted to ask about what you just touched on. You're a Republican. In 2010, you said the death of Her Majesty would be an appropriate time for Australia to move away from having a British head of state. Do you still hold that view?
Yes, I always thought that when the Queen did leave us, that it would cause a period of reflection. I thought that here in the UK, and there are many issues about national identity that the UK is grappling with, the future of Scotland, the future of Northern Ireland, what it means to be the nation in the world without the contact with the European Union that they had, the post-Brexit world in which they now live. And I always thought in Australia too it would unleash a new set of reflections about our own constitutional arrangements. But there's no rush, and I certainly endorse what the Prime Minister has said. There's time for measured discussion. It's certainly too soon for that now. The things that people want to do to honour the Queen, the Prime Minister, our Prime Minister being at the funeral on Monday, all of those things need to be worked through. And then I think we can have a measured, steady discussion, which will ultimately take us, I think, in the direction of a republic, but it won't be quick.
Former Prime Minister Julia Gillard speaking there with James Glenday. In Wales, the death of Queen Elizabeth has reignited debate about the relevance of a Prince of Wales and whether the country still wants one. It's customary for the heir to the British throne to have the title, but it's not automatic. Within days of the Queen's death, King Charles named his son William as Prince of Wales, but some are questioning whether the title is outdated. Correspondent Alison Horne filed this report from Wales.
England 21, Wales 7.
There are a few things that stoke a rivalry like sport. It's England versus Wales in the women's rugby, and emotions are running high.
Make the scrum!
These two countries show fierce rivalry, but over the last week they've had a unifying grief. And in the game's 70th minute, they mark the Queen's 70 years on the throne. For Peter Pinnick, it's a chance to reflect.
It's obviously a really sad occasion. It's a woman that's been in our history for, you know, generations. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're like a royalist or not a royalist. It's still a sad occasion. You know, she's someone's grandmother, she's someone's mother. It should just be treated with a moment of respect.
The Welsh fans in the crowd are adorned in red, green and white hats, wrapped in the Wales flag. They're proud of their country as a standalone nation, and some see the Prince of Wales title as an outdated symbol of English dominance over Wales, like Ryan Lever.
I don't think that Wales as a country has really benefited all that much from having a Prince of Wales per se, you know? I think it's a nice title to have, but it's more of a title rather than promotion of Wales.
You're not opposed to Prince William, is what the sense that I'm sort of getting from you?
No, not at all. It's something which has always been a thing. It just doesn't really have any sort of tangible effect.
Helen Carey says she has nothing personally against the new Prince, William, but he is English.
I think that if you want to be a Prince of Wales, then maybe you should be Welsh. That's all, you know. Nothing else. He's lovely. He's a lovely boy, you know, and his wife is lovely. But they're not Welsh, are they?
Those same sentiments are shared by some in the younger generation, like teenagers Daisy Dalton and Ava Williams.
I feel like Wales should have a say on who they want to be, like, prince or princess.
I feel if, like, Welsh people have, like, a Welsh prince, then that would make them feel more close to them instead of having a prince who's not connected to them at all.
The ruling leader of Wales has acknowledged there is an alive debate around the role and title of the Prince of Wales, but insists now is not the time to have it. Others argue it should be the people's democratic right to decide on whether their country still wants a prince, especially one that's not Welsh. This is Alison Horne in Wales, reporting for AM.
While tens of thousands of people in London are still queuing to pay their respects to Queen Elizabeth, elsewhere in the UK, millions of low-income earners are bracing for the winter months ahead as food and energy prices skyrocket. It's estimated that up to 7 million people across the country are already going without essentials, and that situation is expected to worsen. Sally Sarah reports from South London.
The next station is Brixton, where this train terminates.
Many residents of Brixton are struggling to pay for the basics as food and energy costs hit hard.
It's getting out of hand, to be honest. Some people are quiet about it, some people speak up. But it's not good at all.
Food prices in the UK are rising at the fastest pace in 14 years, and energy bills are off the charts.
Before, when I used to take £50 to shop, I got a lot of change left, but now, not a penny left.
This is Brixton's famous shopping street, Electric Avenue. The street got its name in the 1880s as the first street market in the UK with electric lighting. But now many locals are struggling to keep the power on at home.
Do you think the politicians understand what life's like for people here in Brixton?
People, they don't know what it's like to go without anything.
While UK inflation eased slightly in the last quarter, it's still running at 9.9%, close to a 40-year high. The war in Ukraine, rising prices and underlying inequality have collided. Poverty researcher Helen Barnard from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation says research carried out in May found 4.5 million people across the country were already behind with their bills.
Well, for people on low incomes, it is really quite catastrophic. I mean, there's an enormous amount of fear out there about what's going to happen this winter.
The government has promised a £400 energy rebate and a cap on prices. But many residents of Brixton are still waiting.
We're supposed to get this £400, this thing for the British Gas. Now, they keep putting it back. They keep texting you, and they keep putting it back. I just got a text. They're taking the piss, look. They keep putting us on hold.
Researcher Helen Barnard fears that many low-income earners won't be able to afford heating when winter sets in.
You know, these are not conditions that we want to see anybody living in. Our health service leaders wrote a joint letter to send to the previous Chancellor to say this is going to become an emergency for our National Health Service unless the government steps in.
In Brixton, the current economic crisis is unfolding amid years of disadvantage and discrimination. Many older residents are members of the Windrush generation, who arrived from the Caribbean only to be wrongly classified by the government as illegal immigrants. Despite promises of compensation, many are still facing a bleak winter.
Well, think about the people who've worked hard in this country and as they treat them, old people. We're still waiting. Our mums and dads have come here, still waiting for this Windrush money, and we still haven't got it yet.
A Brixton resident ending Sally Sarah's report. You're listening to AM and it's 20 past seven. The Defence Minister says Australia's ambitious plan to acquire nuclear submarines is starting to take shape. Although it's been a year since the surprise announcement of the Australia-UK-US security pact known as AUKUS, details of the plan remain top secret. However, the Minister insists the eventual model won't be a custom-made design just for Australia, but rather a boat that will also be operated by either the US or the UK. Defence correspondent Andrew Green prepared this report.
Nuclear-powered submarines will allow us to better protect our seas, our people, and our way of life.
For the past 12 months, the Nuclear-Powered Submarine Task Force has been charged with working out how Australia will eventually replace its Collins-class conventionally powered boats.
Nuclear-powered submarines can manoeuvre while remaining undetected and strike without warning.
1 year on from the Morrison government's surprise announcement to dump the $90 billion French submarine project in favour of a nuclear option, Labor insists the ambitious plan is on track.
The optimal pathway is starting to take shape. We can see it.
Defence Minister Richard Marles is receiving regular briefings from the task force as it prepares to deliver findings of its 18-month study in March. According to the Defence Department's incoming brief to government, Australia is still preparing to transition to nuclear-powered submarines in the late 2030s. The minister believes the eventual submarine model will not be a bespoke design or orphan, but rather a nuclear boat that's also used by either the United Kingdom or the United States.
Obviously, it is desirable that the submarine we ultimately operate is also operated by another country. In that way, there is a shared experience in operating the platform. There's also a shared industrial base in maintaining and sustaining it.
Military experts have warned that the eventual cost of a nuclear submarine fleet could be double that of conventionally powered boats. But Richard Marles won't yet be drawn on the question.
Cost is obviously a factor here. We will be in a position when we make our announcements next year in relation to the platform to give a sense of cost that goes with it.
Marcus Hellyer is from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
We all know that nuclear submarines are going to cost more than the attack class. One of the really big questions that at least everybody in defence is thinking is, will it get supplementation, extra money for nuclear submarines, or will it have to somehow take it out of hide and find offsets?
At an overnight event at the conservative Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., marking the anniversary of AUKUS, Shadow Defence Minister Andrew Hastie gave his assessment of the project begun under the coalition.
Our decision to acquire nuclear-powered submarines was both bold and historic. It is a powerful signal that we are going to take responsibility for ourselves and the security of our neighbours. We need to move, though, at warp speed. Time is not on our side.
The former soldier warns Australia's nuclear submarines need to start being delivered in the next decade or sooner.
Andrew Green. About 116,000 people are homeless in Australia every night. To give you an idea of size, that's about the entire Victorian city of Ballarat without a home. The lack of social and affordable housing is a major issue for all governments. Queensland is hosting a roundtable discussion with key interest groups today ahead of a much bigger summit next month. And the federal government says it's working on a plan, but advocates say more must be done immediately. Annie Guest reports.
When people become homeless in Victoria, community group Launch Housing provides affordable homes and crisis support. But CEO Bevan Warner says they're turning more people away than ever.
It's not unusual for us to see clients break down and become very distressed at the uncertain prospects for themselves and their children, or to be faced with the horrible choice of returning to an unsafe situation because that's the best alternative they have.
Domestic violence and poverty are the top two reasons 116,000 Australians are homeless every night.
The choices are pretty grim. It's a mix of precarious housing from couch surfing, rooming houses if they can find them, prevailing on friends, sleeping in cars, in tents, moving into caravans.
Across the country, rents are high and vacancy rates low. In Queensland, the state government is meeting homelessness advocates and builders today ahead of a housing summit next month to discuss action. The Federal Minister for Housing and Homelessness, Julie Collins, agrees too many Australians are struggling to find a home.
So we've got a lot on in terms of an ambitious agenda that we took to the election to try and deal with the housing challenges that Australians are facing.
She recently held her second meeting with state housing ministers.
When talking to states and territories and what they're working on at the moment, they expect collectively to have about 15,500 homes on the ground in the next 2 years. And then our 30,000 social and affordable homes will be on top of that.
But Kate Colvin from the Everybody's Home campaign fears rising interest rates and increased migration will make things worse before then.
We're calling on them to build on the good work that they're already doing to get a housing and homelessness plan in place and work together to immediately increase social housing investment to 25,000 properties a year.
The minister says she's listening.
Well, we are moving as quickly as we can move. But we're also doing things like we've brought forward our regional first home guarantee, which will be starting on the 1st of October. That wasn't supposed to start until the 1st of January.
That government guarantee would allow eligible regional buyers to buy property with a 5% deposit, perhaps a small step towards helping more people into their own home.
Any guest reporting? A West Australian scientist has discovered the world's oldest heart from our ancestors, almost perfectly preserved for 380 million years. The discovery of the organ inside a fossilised fish marks a key evolutionary moment and reveals humans may have evolved in larger leaps than first thought. Jake Sturmer reports.
Kate Trinastic started her career as a cardiac nurse, but you won't find the heart she discovered in any medical textbooks.
It was one of those great moments where we just knew that we had something so significant.
Here at the WA Museum, she's showing me a go-go fish, or at least what's been preserved of one.
So this is the actual specimen that had the heart in it. The first thing I guess I was thinking was we found this and what else is there?
Hundreds of millions of years ago, well before dinosaurs roamed the earth, these strange fish used to swim in an ancient sea in WA's northwest. The Curtin University professor and her colleagues didn't just find a heart, but also a stomach and liver, almost perfectly preserved for 380 million years.
This is the most complete set of organs we've ever got in a jawed vertebrate. And we ourselves actually belong to the group of jawed vertebrates. So these are some of our earliest ancestors.
The discovery, published in the journal Science, also shows how the head and neck began to change to accommodate jaws, a critical stage in the evolution of our own bodies.
We tend to think of evolution as happening as a series of small steps, but this discovery showed us that in our earliest ancestors, the changes occurred as a big bang, all in one hit.
A few decades ago, finding soft tissue like this would have been impossible, but thanks to modern scanning techniques, scientists can peer into the fossils without having to dissolve them with acid. Dr. Martin Brazeau is from the Imperial College London.
Up to now, most of what we know about from fossils like this are the bones, because the bones are the only things that really preserve as fossils. It's very rare to find evidence of soft tissues.
He says it's an important discovery.
This is sort of a key evolutionary moment in terms of the evolution of all animals with backbones. So especially the ones with jaws and teeth, such as ourselves, and as well as animals like sharks and so on.
Some of the scientists involved in the discovery now want the Fitzroy Crossing area placed on the World Heritage List, preserving the place that's preserved so many clues about our origins.
Jake Sturmer reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The east coast of Australia is in the midst of a third La Niña. But is this summer necessarily going to be as wet as it's been in the past 2 years? Today, meteorologist and ABC weather presenter Tom Saunders on what to expect and why there's always a silver lining. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.